Hi, everybody. I'm Don Landis. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know if I'm committed or I should be committed, but... And Bob, thank you for picking me up at the airport and that kind introduction. And thank you to the committee for doing all the hard work. When you're in a room like this and you look around and you see everything so well organized and everybody seems to know what they're doing and there's this great spirit in the room, you can make the mistake of thinking it just happens. And so thank you to the committee, because I've been doing committee work for over 30 years and I know what goes on here. And how nice it is to be back together in Alcoholics Anonymous in this format, together with this spirit in the room. And I love the spirit in this room. Last night was remarkable. I mean, Jane had the room rocking and rolling. Everybody was screaming and yelling, "Ooh!" And I'm like, oh, I forgot. Yeah. It's like they opened the door to the asylum and we come together. And what's your problem? I'm sober. You know. And I love the spirit. I love the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I'm in a room like this, you know, always find a way to get in the corner away from everybody. Just get away from everybody and get quiet myself and close my eyes. And I'll listen to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous in a room like this. Everybody talking, that electric hum. Nobody listening. Nobody. And I experienced that last night, and I'm so grateful for what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I'll tell you my sobriety date, September 16th, 1991. I turned 30 years sober last September. I have a home group. It's the SOS Men's Group. We meet on Monday and Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock at St. James Church on 14th Street in the Fairhaven District of Bellingham, Washington. And it's a men's group where men are men. And the mental illness is not measurable. It's just... But we are committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. We are committed to each other. And we're a good mix, man. There's a lot of new guys getting sober there, learning how to live. A lot of old goats like me trying to keep the young guys, showing them how, you know, what was given to us. And this is the best story I can tell you about. I'll just tell you a quick story about my home group to understand what really happens when you're a member of that group. About 5 years ago, we had a couple of new guys come in, Ben and Matt. And Ben and Matt were not the sharpest knives in the drawer. We'll just leave it at that. And these guys quickly were attracted because water seeks its own level. And then they were living together. And they were new in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you're pretty good when you're working and you're going to meetings, but that free time will make you crazy. So they were finding interesting ways to fill up their free time, one of which is they were tattooing each other. Now, you might ask yourself, oh, is one of them a tattoo artist? Oh, no. What? They just got a tattoo gun on Amazon and off they went. And they were getting matching tattoos of dumpster fires and things like that on their... And they'd come into the group and they'd show us their latest tattoos and they were just knuckleheads. And, you know, as you know, at the coffee break and after the meeting where the real good conversations of spirituality go on in a home group, I was talking to these two young men one day, and they were about 90 days sober at that time. And Matt was telling me what they were up to and what his plans for the future was. And I said, Matt, you stay on that trajectory. You're just not going to stay sober, brother. I love you, but it's not going to happen. And he got very indignant about it. And I said, Matt, I am so sure if you don't change your ways, a guy like you would never see anything like 5 years. And I said, I'm so sure of it. If you get 5 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll let you tattoo me. Now, this is all covered in a very long, snappy conversation. That was just one little throwaway line. I didn't mean it. But I saw Matt's face change. And I saw Ben's eyes light up. And I saw these young men grab a new level of commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous in sobriety that I had not seen in them yet. When I turned 30 years sober, they threw me a party. It happened to coincide with when Matt and Ben turned five. Prior to that event, I had no tattoos on my body. I have one now. And, you're more than well. I'll show you after the meeting. It is. You would have to go to a grade B blind federal institution to get work of this quality. Trust me. My poor wife. She didn't know this was happening, and with all my good friends in my home group and all these people standing around, and my birthday cake right over there, as Matt was tattooing me, my wife walked into the kitchen. She didn't say it. She just looked and went, "Oh, good Lord." Because she wasn't surprised. She's seen my act for 30 years, you know what I mean? And I mean this in all sincerity. If you're new here today, if I thought something as simple as putting some ink on my body would buy you 5 years, I'd tattoo my whole body for you. Because I know where you've been. And I know what brought you here. I know everything about you. We got anybody here in their first 90 days of sobriety? Raise your hand. Wow. Well done. You wouldn't have caught me in a room like this in 90 days, 60 days, 70 days, 40 days. I could barely make eye contact at that point. I just stayed really close to my sponsor. In fact, he told me, stop talking to the old timers. You're scaring them, you know. But I'll tell you, it's a weird thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you come in here and we're so damn glad to see you and we want you to have a shot at this thing. And it can be repellent to the new person. We come at you with those hands and those teeth. And how are you doing? And we're expecting a miracle. They did that to me. We're expecting a miracle. And I'd think, he should be expecting a head wound. You need to back off, you know. I mean, I just came off the streets. It's a little overwhelming. I'm detoxing. I got audio and visual hallucinations. And you want to hug me? That's a bad idea. That's a bad move, Scooter, you know. And the reason we're so damn glad to see you is we know you got a shot. We know you made it to the room. We know if you stay here, you'll be one day be able to say this, the worst part of my life is over. How many people in the world can say that because of their membership in a place called Alcoholics Anonymous? We get to say something like that. And we know you. Oh, clap, why not? And we know you. And I know that was so insulting to me. The low point of my existence, new in Alcoholics Anonymous, some well-meaning old-timer would say, I know you. I've been right where you're at. And you think, no, you haven't. Look at you. Look at you. Wearing clean clothes, big show-off that you are. Got stuff I can never imagine having. Because there's show-offs in AA. You know, when you're new in AA, everybody's a show-off. You got stuff I can't imagine ever having. Like a valid driver's license, you know what I mean? And oh, that's not the showing off part. There's an address on the license, and if you go there, they live there. That's just crazy talk. But we know a great deal about you if you're new. And you think, how is that possible? You don't know me. You haven't heard my story. Listen, if you're new, we know a lot about you. For instance, this hasn't been a good year. Because it wasn't a good year for us when we got here, right? Nobody gets here on a winning streak. Nobody goes, well, the portfolio's doing well, the job's good, the kids are good, everybody's happy, I wave at the police every day. I think I'll go to AA and do something about all that Chardonnay I'm drinking. Just doesn't happen. This is the last place we want to show up, and it was the last place I ever thought I'd get. You know, I'm not just grateful to be sober, I'm kind of amazed. Because I'm the guy that for a long time didn't think I wanted this gift. And then once I wanted it, I knew I'd never have it. I knew I'd never be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because hadn't I tried everything I could think of to put down the drink? And I'm an alcoholic. I'm that one-trick pony. I can put down the drink and I can even walk away from it, but I can't stay stopped. And my experience before Alcoholics Anonymous tells me this. I may have every consequence in the world, every reason, billboard size, neon lit information that says, Don shouldn't drink. And I agree with it. The fun is gone. The party's over. I haven't enjoyed it in a long time, yet I'm drunk most nights. I know everything there is to know about being powerless long before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm convinced that your love, all you good people, all your steps, your God, your sponsorship, your making coffee, your setting up and cleanup, everything that I see when I'm new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I look around and it seems to be what? An inadequate answer for what I suffer from. I know I'm going to drink again. I know it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And the fact that I stand in front of you sober today, not fighting the drink, I'm overpaid as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not all that other stuff. You know, if you talk to someone that didn't understand alcoholism, and they were to look at my life the day before I came to this event today, they would have seen a man that woke up sleeping peacefully in a bed next to a beautiful woman that he's been married to for 25 years. Bo the Wonder Dog is sleeping at the foot of the bed peacefully. I can move quickly in front of that dog and that woman, and neither one of them flinches. If you know what that means, you're an alcoholic of my type. Nobody cries in that house. It's a comfortable home. When I get up to leave for work, there's usually deer in the front yard that I can get within 3 feet of because my wife won't stop feeding them. Hey, good morning. You got anything for us? You know that. I got into a comfortable work vehicle and went to a job I've been at for the last 18 years where they expect me to show up on time. They would be worried. They would call not to say, where are you, in anger, but are you okay if I showed up late? Because I never show up late. They've come to expect that kind of consistency from me. There are men that count on me at that place of employment. I go in and I set guys up for the day. I go through my business day and I do the things that I do to earn a living. And people that I encounter are treated with dignity, respect, and responsibility. And they think that's me. They have no idea. They just had a close encounter with a beautiful program called Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, as we move through the world, what we do will speak louder than anything we say. We are examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. We show people there's a way out. We show people there's resurrection. We show people there's another way to go. And there's a little strength left in us yet. And then I come home after a day like that and I pack and I come and I get the honor and privilege of traveling from Bellingham, Washington. If you don't know where that is, I'll tell you. We're 100 miles north of Seattle, 20 miles south of the Canadian border. America's first defense against Canada, I suppose. And it's beautiful. Snow-capped mountains and streams and rivers and a beautiful bay. And like I said, if you didn't know anything about alcoholism, you would look at the outside stuff in my life. You would look at the trappings of a long, sober life. And you'd say, whoo, boy, that Alcoholics Anonymous, it really works, doesn't it? They don't know a damn thing about alcoholism. It's not the stuff you can see. It's the stuff you can't see I'm excited about. You got to understand there's a calm in my belly and a clarity in my mind. I sleep like a baby at night. I'm not looking over my shoulder. I haven't hurt anybody in a very, very long time. I live in peace and in constant companionship with the Creator I didn't believe in when I got here. I'm overpaid. There's a bounce in my step and a glint in my eye. I'm the guy that will tell you, don't miss Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best damn thing that ever happened to me. And it'll be the best damn thing that ever happened to you. And you'd be a fool to miss it. And I'll tell that to anybody. You see, I walk with that spirit on a daily basis. And here's the beauty of it. You can't take it from me. My sobriety given to me by your program that you allowed me to be a part of. But it's mine. You see, it's a gift that comes disassembled, I will admit that. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were people here that had the spiritual tools and showed me how to put the gift together. And the gift has been put together in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is mine. It is firmly in place. It is mine to take care of it. That is the garden I must tend, number one in my life. But nobody can take it from me. Now, a lot of things in life can be taken from you. And I've had them taken from me. I've had my money taken from me, my health taken from me, my employment taken from me. You know, I've had things taken from me. But they can't take your sobriety. Nobody will ever take your sobriety. But many of us renounce it. Many of us turn it back in. And I'm here to offer that if you're new, I don't care if you're one day or 100 years, cling to it, grasp it, keep it close to your chest, care for it as you would anything that's the most precious thing that you possess. How would I have known at 7 days sober, 14 days sober, 128 days sober, 15 months sober? How would I know at those points in my sobriety that the most important and precious thing I had was the fact that I was just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was physically sober, getting to come to rooms like this with people like you and enjoy the gift one more day, a gift that I didn't think I wanted, and once I got it, I knew I'd never keep it. Yet here I am, beating the odds. And I'm not unique. Available to every man and woman. Isn't that something? Isn't God good? Isn't God good? Aren't we all His kids? I think about my Heavenly Father and what I put Him through when I was out there running and gunning and things I did to His other children. And I think about the smile and maybe the tear He shed the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And all His other kids that He had performed this resurrection on that were waiting for me seemingly their whole life. I started drinking drunk when I was 17 years old. That's not my first drink. I'm not interested in my first drink. I find it interesting when people remember their first drink. I think that's terrific. I mean, I'm sure it was half a Budweiser or a glass of wine or something that I stole from somebody. I'm talking about when I got drunk for the first time, when I got enough alcohol on board in one setting to get there. And you know where there is. Because alcohol, as much as anything, it transports me. It takes me to the land of, I don't care. And that's where I want to live. That's where I want my mail delivered, right? I love the sense of ease and comfort that comes almost immediately with taking a couple of drinks. And here's the thing, I don't have to get drunk to get that sense of ease and comfort. You know, once trouble came into my story, man, I'm not drinking to get drunk or to black out, crash a car, break a heart, break a promise. That's not why I'm drinking. I just want to have a couple. Don't you? Just a couple. Just to get the edge up. And it's tough out there. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And I'm wearing milk-bone underwear, you know? But as I said before, I'm an alcoholic, right? I'd like to think I know a little bit about what that means today because of what I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that I agree with, right? I got the physical component of alcoholism. I may want to have a couple to get that sense of ease and comfort, and I will get it. But I have an allergic reaction, right? An unnatural reaction to beverage alcohol that only 10% of the population gets, which means this, one's too many, a thousand's not enough. You put alcohol in my system of any type, I can't stop drinking or predict with any accuracy what's going to happen to a fool like me once I start to drink. And I don't know that. I don't know it because I only drink in my own body and I only live in my own mind, which means what? I'm drinking in ignorance from the beginning. And when you drink in ignorance and you happen to be an alcoholic and you don't know it, you're bringing a knife to a gunfight. It's going to get ugly. And I don't know that. I want to be clear about this. This is why alcohol, we say, it's a subtle foe. What do they mean by that? Alcohol is a subtle foe. What's more subtle than something trying to kill you that doesn't let you know it's trying to kill you? What's more subtle than something that makes you different than your fellows, only you feel like they're the problem? That's subtle. I want to be clear, I've never been confused by my drinking. Now, my drinking may have appeared confusing and bizarre to others that were watching me drink. But I want to be clear, I have never taken a drink and felt it was the wrong time, the wrong amount, the wrong reason. It's always felt, you know whose drinking confuses me? Their drinking. Normal people's drink. It's confusing, isn't it? They say weird stuff when they drink, like, oh, I'm starting to feel it. Yeah. Followed up what? I've had enough. It hurts me to say it today. One of the big lies my mother told me. I remember my mother, when I was a small boy, told me, Donald, enough is enough. No, it's not. Because I'm an alcoholic, but I don't know that normal people have a normal reaction to alcohol. That stuff's poison. You put poison in your body starts telling you, I think we've had enough. We're talking too loud. I'm feeling out of control. I think people are looking at me. And they say things like, no, I'm good. They don't have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, get a sponsor, a tyrannical figure in their life. They don't have to show up early and stay late, sponsor people that won't listen to them. They don't have to do none of it. They just stop and they skip down the merry road and they go and they say things to people like us, well, just don't drink so much. And you know the guy I'm talking about, man. It's 11 o'clock at night, right? You got to the bar at what? 5:30. You have a commitment. Right? You have an investment of time, energy, and money. And it's just getting good. You know, 11 o'clock's the witching hour for an alcoholic that got there at 5:30. You got a half a load on, man, and you met some new friends. You're going to be in business forever. You know it. And it's music sounding perfect. That waitress you weren't interested in, now she's got potential. I mean, everything's turned around. And then there's that one guy, man. He just stands up, looks at his watch, and announces, wow, I didn't realize it was getting so late. I got to work tomorrow. And he goes home. Doesn't have to come to AA, get a sponsor, work 12 golden steps, nothing. He just goes home. I don't understand that kind of drinking. I don't understand the half-finished drink any more than that. Here's my favorite story about social drinking. When my wife Eileen, and Eileen is sober 30 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, good member of AA, boy meets girl on AA campus. And when we got engaged, my family was delighted. They loved Eileen. They threw an engagement party for us, and everybody came, right? So there's a lot of social drinking going on. And we're in the kitchen with my non-alcoholic sister. She's got her glass of white wine, and we've got our club sodas, and we're just talking. And she saw some people arrive at the party and wanted to welcome them and said, oh, I'll be right back. And she set her wine down on the counter and left the room. My wife noticed that. And in a troubled voice, she said to me, she said, Pat left your wine. And I said, yes, she did, baby. She goes, well, should I go tell her? And I said, baby, baby, baby. At this particular moment, she's not suffering from separation anxiety. Early part of my drinking, there's no trouble. Remember that? The salad days you're drinking, right? 21, 22, 23. I'm not standing in courtrooms trying to explain to a judge my latest event of outrageous behavior. You know, I don't have my mom standing in front of me crying her eyes out going, don't you know you're killing yourself? I don't have girlfriends hiding in closets because I'm tearing the house apart in a blackout again and they don't know what I'm going to do. Now, at 23, if you had told me about those things, I wouldn't have believed you. At 23 years old, if God Almighty had walked into the bar I was drinking in and said, Don, the next one, the very next one's going to pass you into a region where there's no return to human aid. You're going to have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of your life or die a horrible alcoholic death, I'd have told God Almighty, you got the wrong guy. Because it was working for me from the inside out, from my toes to my head. It's allowing me to be anything I want to be and not feel anything I don't want to feel. Going up the ladder in business, making a ton of money, dating up a storm. To the outside world, if you look at me, it looks like I'm a guy that's going places. But there's signs already. There's wear around the edges. And trouble is coming into my story. And I'll tell you, I wish that the pain that other people experienced as a result of the actions I take when I drink was some kind of stimuli for me to stop or change. But it's not. It's not a problem for me until it's a problem for me. I can't tell you how many times I had a girlfriend standing in front of me crying her eyes out. Don't you know how I feel? I'd be like, not really. I told this one girl, I go, listen, I'm drinking and you're watching me drink. And I think one's more fun than the other. I just didn't get it. And you know, trouble don't get an alcoholic. So, God, we get in trouble, right? And our families think, well, that'll get his attention. You know, we go to jail, crash a car, lose a job, break a heart. That'll get his attention. Well, it gets our attention. But here's the difference between me and the heavy drinker. You give a heavy drinker a sufficient reason to quit, right? You tell a heavy drinker, you keep drinking, you're going to lose your job, your family, and your health. Heavy drinker goes, man, I don't want to lose that stuff. Actually stops drinking. You tell an alcoholic that, this is where we're confusing to our friends, our family, our employers, and the people around us. You look at me and you think, I don't care. I have the same emotional reaction as the heavy drinker. I don't want to lose my job, my health, my family. But the needed power to stop just isn't there. It's not any more complicated than that. You see, it started for me the first time I got drunk and I didn't know it. People talk about the progression of alcoholism. In my case, the progression was very quick. And I've heard you tell your stories about getting drunk for the first time since the day I walked in. We all sound the same, don't we? Yeah, I got drunk for the first time when I was 17. I felt 10 feet tall. I felt better looking. I felt confident. I felt smarter. I felt this. I felt that. I felt like I could dance. And we talk about it as though it's fantasy or delusion. I don't think so. I mean, the big book says every man and woman is blessed with certain skills, aptitudes, and abilities. These are your gifts from God. These are the things you've always been naturally good at. And everybody gets a different set of gifts. Some people can dance, some people can draw, some people can do math, some people are good looking, but we all get our own gifts. What if your gifts, your birthright from your Creator, always felt that they were, I don't know, just outside of your reach, just beyond your grasp, that you suspected they were there, you hoped they were there, but you couldn't quite make contact with them? Something in AA we like to refer to as what? Potential. And then one day something as powerful as alcohol came into my life, and let me tell you what, it's not fantasy and it's not delusion. I am smarter. I am funnier. I am stronger. And I am more of everything I ever suspected and hoped I could be. And it's not any more complicated than this. I like the way I feel with a couple of drinks in me more than the way I feel when I'm sober. And I don't understand that seals my fate. You see, I get brainwashed before I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, don't I? We've all been brainwashed by the time we get here. And what's the brainwashing? And who does it? That's where it's dangerous. You know who does the brainwashing? The people that love us the most. Family members. District attorneys. Doctors that are stitching us up and we don't feel the needle. And these well-meaning people say things like, they said it to me, I'm sure they said it to you. Oh, you're a great person. You have so much potential. Oh, you could go anywhere you wanted to go, be anything you wanted to be if you just quit drinking. You'd be so happy if you just quit drinking. And when they said those things to me, I laid my experience against it, and what do I find out? I smacked that cop. I was drinking. Went to jail. I was drinking. Lost the job. I was drinking. Crashed the car. I was drinking. Yeah. It's easy for me, based on consequence, to make whiskey the culprit. And to think that drinking's my problem rather than my solution. Only when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous did you point out to me that I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a living problem. That I'd been using a solution that would eventually kill me and tear the cover off my life and hurt everyone that had the misfortune of caring about a guy like me. But my real problem was I couldn't live life on life's terms in a sober state. And how true for the alcoholic of my type. You know, my problems, as bad as it looks when I'm drinking, it's nothing compared to what happens to me when I put the plug in the jug and I just don't drink and I just hang on. And trouble doesn't get a guy like me sober. It may get the heavy drinker sober. But, you know, I'm a drinking drunk, man, and my alcoholism will always keep pace with consequence. You know, my alcoholism gave me the two best friends that drinking drunks ever had, justification and rationalization. And what does that look like? I got to be able to go to jail. And upon my release to face my family, I had to be able to look them in the eye with a smile on my face and laughingly say, well, everybody goes to jail once in a while. No, they don't. I used to ask normal people, and you know what? I stopped doing it. It was embarrassing. Most people, I mean, not in this room, but most people haven't gone to jail. I mean, I had people go, why would you ask me that? Oh, just curious. Have you been to jail? Oh, no, I didn't. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You don't believe me? Let's play a game. How many people in this room, show of hands, how many people in this room have ever been handcuffed? Just raise your hand. Oh. It's worse in Georgia than most places. I just... There's two things I want to point out to you. First thing I want to point out to you is that doesn't happen at the Rotary Club. I just want you to know. Now, the other thing I want to point out is in a room like this, when you ask a question like that, who's been handcuffed, this is what we think. Well, that's a stupid question. Why would he ask that? Well, he's a nice guy. I'll play along, you know. Our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Through consequence, pain, failure of our human resources. If you're like me, you'll wake up one day and you'll realize you're living a life that's unacceptable. I live the kind of life at the end of my drinking that if you put a normal, healthy, well-adjusted, mature human being in my life, for an hour, they would go running down the street in terror. But for me, it had become what? Tuesday. Friday night. Monday morning. Remember Monday morning, the oops, I did it again morning? Oh, such high hopes going into the weekend. I'm not going to do this, that, and the other thing. And we did it all. And we did more of it. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Where am I at time, Lee? If you can just give me an idea how long I've been blathering.
Yeah, 30 minutes into it.
Okay, that's beautiful. Thanks. I was having too much fun. I'm like, what is it? Is it Sunday yet? So trouble doesn't get a guy like me sober. I use justification and rationalization. Victimization, that's a big one too, isn't it? I know it looks like my fault, but it's not. And let me tell you why. I wouldn't have done what I did if you didn't do what you did or said what you did. And we become masters of that. People come to us with their hurt feelings, their hurt emotion, their dented fenders, and we just judo flip it back on them. Well, if you hadn't, then they end up apologizing to us. We get really good at it. And what I started to do at age 25, because 25 was a turning point in my drinking, 25 is when I got self-knowledge. Self-knowledge kills guys like me. Now, the whole world believes in it. People that don't understand alcoholism believe in self-knowledge. It's what outpatient treatment's all about. To a degree, that's what inpatient treatment's about. It's information. It's good information. It's accurate information. Give them the information. And the people giving us the information, if they're not alcoholic, feel that they're helping us. And we receive it and we think, oh, this is great. Now I understand. This is important. Oh, that's why I do that. That's why I was locked up for 14 days and got out of jail after 14 days of saying I will never drink again and walked across the street to a liquor store and bought a six-pack. Oh, that's why I did that. Well, good, I won't have to do that anymore for the next time I do it. And long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned that information, self-knowledge, doesn't get a guy like me sober. But when it happens, it feels powerful. And if self-knowledge is not delivered by a family member or a court system. You know, self-knowledge, it came to me at 2 o'clock in the morning in a dirty motel room. And there's all this screaming in the room. And I realize I'm alone in the room. The screaming's in my head, in my voice, the same message. You're going to die if you don't do something about your drinking. And I got it. Whew. It felt like a solution. It felt powerful. It felt like hope. Like I don't have to do this anymore. And I didn't run off and join AA. I made the alcoholic declaration that many of us do when we first have self-knowledge. I told everybody I'm quitting drinking, so don't try to tempt me. I called up my pharmaceutical rep of record and he said, don't sell me anything, even if I beg, because they are very reputable. They won't sell you anything if you ask them not to. No, Don, I can't take your $500. You made me promise. And I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not join your tribe, and I quit drinking without you. Thank you very much. For 2 weeks. And that's a turning point, man. And in that 2 weeks, I really think that's where the tentacles, the muscles of alcoholism really started to spread out in my story and really start to damage the family. Right? Because there's an expression that's ignorance is bliss. And unbeknownst to me, man, all those years of my drinking, all those trips to jail, those crashed cars, those broken hearts and broken promises, my family, who loves me tremendously, was having those back room meetings. And I guarantee you they had those meetings about you. And they're saying things like, what are we going to do about Donald, man? He's drinking himself to death. He's just a knucklehead. We don't know what's going to happen next. They go, well, I don't know. We talked to him about it. He just laughs it off. He says when he gets in enough trouble, he'll quit. He says, don't have to worry about him. He's wearing a young man's clothes, doing what young men do. He doesn't get it. And ignorance is bliss, not just for me, but for the family. And then what happens? I have self-knowledge and I look my family in the eye, I look my mother in the eye, I look my sisters in the eye, and I say, I'm quitting drinking forever. I can't do this anymore. It's killing me. And they all breathe a collective sigh. And I don't understand it. I've just given my family the cruelest gift that a drinking drunk can give their family. I give them false hope. Because they're having those backroom meetings and they're sharing the good news, aren't they? Did you hear? Did you hear? I quit drinking. No, he didn't go to jail or nothing. It was his idea. No, he's doing good. No, he's going to work 5 days a week. It's amazing. And in a short 2 week period of physical sobriety, the outside stuff that the work can see gives them hope because it starts looking better. Laundry starts getting done. I show up to work. I'm showing up where I say I'm going to be. I'm back in the gym. And everybody sees the outside and they say to themselves, he's doing so well. And they say to me, oh, you're doing so well. But the problem is they can't see the inside. And with every day that goes by since my last drunk, I'm getting more irritable, restless, and discontent. And that's right in the doctor's opinion. And it explains what happens to a guy like me. Really, it starts 2 to 5 days after I quit drinking every time. It's my idea. And 2 to 5 days later, a little voice in my head says, forever. Because by then, what's happened, right? The color started to drip out of the picture and my world starts to turn gray. And I start to think maybe I made a bad decision with this quitting drinking thing. And I become irritable, restless, and discontent. I'm here to offer, that's the biggest understatement in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? Because it don't feel that way. I'm irritable. I want to hurt you. I'm restless. Maybe I'll go over there. Nope, I don't like them. Maybe I'll go over there. Nope, they don't like me. Maybe I'll get some ice cream. God, I'm getting fat. You know, it just doesn't matter what I'm doing and who I'm doing it with. I'm doing the wrong thing with the wrong people. I can't find any comfort. And I'm discontent. And discontent means this and nothing less. I'm unhappy regardless of the situations and status in my life. You can look me in the eye and go, you should be so grateful. You're doing so well. Doesn't matter. Let me tell you what alcoholics of my type like. You know what we're good at as a society? We're better at it than any other group of people I've ever seen. We're good at doing wrong. We handle wrong really well. We are children of chaos. Give me something to point my finger at to explain why I'm screwed up. Give me a reversal of fortune. Give me a bad medical diagnosis. Give me a broken heart. But give me something to explain why I'm feeling so crappy, right, in my sober state. You know what we can't stand? You know what makes a guy like me actually lose my mind? When nothing's wrong. But I feel like something's wrong. And there's people in this room know exactly what I'm talking about. And let me tell you, that doesn't just happen when you're new. I remember being there, 8 years sober, lying in bed. All my dreams have come true. I'm doing that spiritual math. Maybe you've done it too. I don't know, man. There's Eileen. She's married to me. Beautiful woman. Says she loves me. That's awesome. That's a gift from God. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor half of North America. They're doing well. I think that's pretty good. I'm in a great home group with a great sponsor. That's going well. I got a business career. I'm knocking it out of the park. I'm making more money than I ever thought I would. Become a homeowner. I vote in elections. Oh my God, I've been returned to sanity. I'm just a blessed guy. Well, if it was any better, I'd go in the backyard and hang myself. You know, because I can't feel it. Because I can't feel it and I don't understand it. I'm cut off from God. I don't understand that I'm running the show. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more dangerous for an alcoholic of my type than have all your dreams come true in sobriety. Get everything that the world is brainwashing you into thinking if you have these things, you'll be okay. And then you get them and you can't figure out why you're still discontent. And your sponsor comes up to you and I go, man, I'm so screwed up. I know I have no reason to feel this way. As everything in my life is a blessing, but why do all my blessings feel like burdens? All these things that I wanted that I thought I would fall on my knees and cry tears of gratitude that they happened, they've come to pass and now they feel burdensome. They feel like things I have to take care of. I feel like I'm put upon. He goes, Don, you're running the show. And we look at our sponsors and we look them in the eye and we go, that's not it. Because by then I got years of sobriety under my belt and I'm taking men through the steps and I'm looking at my bank account and I don't think that's it. And I'll tell you what, irritable, restless, and discontent is available to me right now. All I have to do is run the show for a little while. All I have to do is forget that I'm not cured of alcoholism. What I really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Saying many times each day to myself, thy will be done. Just remembering, I'm in the back seat. God's driving. And when I forget that long enough, the walls start coming in. And what's weird is you can't see the subtle destructive nature of untreated alcoholism. Because I will look fine. I will go to work. I will pay my bills. I will smile and I will chew with my mouth closed. Because you've grown me up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what am I really guilty of? Of creating a better stage character in sobriety. But in the quiet of the evening, in the honesty that lives in my soul, I will know that I'm off the mark. And I will feel that icy fear produced by untreated alcoholism. And it's this and nothing less. We're scared and we don't know why. I used to go to my sponsor and I go, I don't know what it is. I have this sense of impending doom. He'd go, well, you know what that is? I go, no. He goes, that's doom impending. And he'd say cute things to me like, well, you can certainly talk about the third step. Maybe you want to give a shot at living it. And he'd walk away. I go, what the hell is that about? I gave a talk once. I was 10 years sober. I had an old-timer woman come up to me, and she smiled. And she's very nice, very gentle. She said, I think it's wonderful that you talk about how your attitude about women has changed. But we just want to know when it's going to improve. And then she walked away. Let me tell you, that's why it's important to stay close here. Because if you're like me, my alcoholism makes me really dumb about one thing. Dumber about this one thing than anything else in the universe. I'm a moron about this one thing. I'm really smart about a lot of stuff. But this one thing, I'm an idiot. You know what it is? My life. You don't think that's dangerous? Oh my God, what if the one thing you're dumbest about is seeing yourself accurately? You better stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because fortunately for us, you are now surrounded by a group of people that by their own admission can't run their life, but will be more than happy to tell you how to run yours. And you know what's crazy? They're going to be accurate. They're going to be so accurate about your life. Do you want to know why sponsorship works? I love this. We get so twisted up about sponsorship. You know, I got to get the right sponsor. What if I get the wrong sponsor? The only wrong sponsor you can get is sponsor yourself. That's the only wrong sponsor. Right? This is why sponsorship works for a guy like me. My sponsor doesn't have my emotions about my life. That's it. That's it. He can see me clearly. He doesn't have the veil, wants, fears, desires. There's no justification and rationalization. You know, I've never come to my sponsor and talked to him. You know, I'll talk about how I feel and what happened. I'm trying to build this case about what's going on. And he'll just cut through all of it. He'll go, shut up. And I'll go, what? I was telling you, shut up. What did you do? Well, listen, that morning, no. What did you? Because you can't defend what you did. And he will make me say out loud what I did. You see, he gets to the truth of the matter. My alcoholism distorts everything. It creates this whole persona where it's I'm always the victim and you're the perpetrator. Sponsorship takes all that away because it makes us talk about reality. So I did everything you can read about in chapter 3, various vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking. Brief periods of recovery followed always by a still worse relapse. A feeling I was gaining control to find out I'd lost even more control. Pulled the big geographic, left Los Angeles, moved to Boston for 3 years. Found out, much to my chagrin, they drink in Boston. You know what I mean? Wore out my welcome there. I came back to L.A. 2 weeks after I hit L.A., after being gone for 3 years, I get the best job I've ever had in my life. I don't mean why I was drinking. Maybe to this day, the best job I've ever had. Because I'm an alcoholic, and alcoholics are like a cat flung outside a second-story window. And we will land on our feet, boom, in a three-piece suit at a job interview. And we'll get the job. I got no problem getting the job, getting the girl, getting the money. I just can't keep any of it. You know what I mean? We're great getters, poor keepers, you know? And you know the rest of the story. I did a great job, proved myself to this company, making an obscene amount of money. And then the owner of the company made that fatal mistake you sometimes make with alcoholics. He put his arm around me real affectionately and said, "Dong, we want you to know you've done a great job for us." And there's a translator. An alcoholic translator that lives in my brain. It must, because you say something like that to me, this is what I hear. You should probably slack off. You know, I proved myself. What's more to do? And you know the rest of the story. I stopped hiding my drinking. Now I'm missing work. I'm showing up drunk, and they fire me for my drinking. That's not a big deal. I play the victim card. You know, I call my sister in Simi Valley, California. You know, they threw me away after all I did for them, you know. And she says, "You can come stay at my house, but if you drink, you're out of my house." Because everybody knows I'm a drunk, right? And I told my beautiful sister, Patricia, who I love as much as anyone on the planet, "I won't drink, I promise." And I drank every day in that house for 8 months. And if you don't know how you do that when they're watching you, maybe you're not a sneaky rat like I am. I got no problem drinking around your schedule. I'm unemployed, right? What time do you go to work in the morning? 7 a.m., bars open. It's the end of my drinking. It's not to make myself think I'm better looking at it. This is oblivion drinking, light switch drinking. Get the whiskey on hard enough and fast enough to shut off the head so you can black out so I can come to in a room I'm mooching off my family to meet the hideous four horsemen. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, asking us those questions, making those statements. "Who are you going to hurt today, Don? You've ripped off everybody in your life, Don. You've taken every good thing that's ever come your way and you've torn it to shreds. How is it going to end for a guy like, I don't know what you do with a head like that on a hangover morning." But I just took another pull off the jug and I swore it was going to end that way. I don't see any way out. And I'm lying to my family and I'm stealing from my family. And I'm getting unemployment checks every 2 weeks and going on these vicious runs. And I didn't understand there's no room for the truth where the game of alcoholism is played out. You see, every time I told you I don't want to drink anymore, I wasn't lying. Every time I told you I was quitting and I meant it for now and forever, I wasn't lying. I didn't understand the needing power to honor the commitment wasn't there. There's no room for the truth where this thing's concerned. Alcoholism tells us what the truth is. Alcoholism tells us what we're going to do. I don't understand. I've lost the power of choice where the drink's concerned. And I don't know it. So I'm acting like a guy who's still involved in the decision-making process. And my alcoholism laughs and I just get drunk again. I got an unemployment check, went up to my brother-in-law, Larry, and I said, "Larry, I got my check. I'd like to borrow your car and go cash it." And Larry said a very funny thing. He said, "Don, will you be coming back this time?" Because I had been borrowing his car that summer and disappearing several times. And the 12 and 12 says my outstanding characteristic is defiance. And when Larry said that, I got right in his face. And I said, "Larry, how dare you?" You know, the last time this happened, I apologized. I opened my heart to you, Larry. I don't really need this crap. And Larry, poor untreated Al-Anon that he was, you know, took the keys out of his pocket and I snatched the keys from this man who I'm mooching a room off to get in his car. And I remember thinking, there better be gas in it. I went down to the liquor store to cash that check, because that's where alcoholics of my type cash their unemployment checks. And while I'm in line, I have what the big book refers to as the thought that precedes the first drink. And for me, it's always the same. What's in a half pint of whiskey? Nobody ever went to jail behind a half pint of whiskey. And I get the half pint, and I drink it in the parking lot. It goes so well, I get another half pint, and I drink that. And I think, I can be in the valley and back in 45 minutes, go visit those friends. They won't even miss me. And I am gone. 3 days later, I'm driving up the hill to face that family I'd done over one more time. Once again, I've taken their hope, their faith, and their trust, and I've torn it to shreds. And you need to understand, I love my family no less at that moment than I love them right now. And I love my family tremendously. But I can't serve two masters. Only got time to serve one. And that's King Alcohol. You get between me and a drink, it's nothing personal. I'm going around you, through you, manipulating you, but I'm getting to the drink. But when you don't understand alcoholism, you can't warn them. You can't say, look, I know what I did was awful, but that's not the bad news. You want to know the bad news? I'm going to do it again. I'm going to look you in the eye, and I'm going to tell you how sorry I am and how much I love you, and I don't want to live this way, and please give me another chance. And then the minute your back's turned, the minute you take a breath and you think you could trust me, I'm going to do it again. And I don't want to do it. You think I want to live this way? You don't understand. I wake up every day. It's in the room with me, that thought. Not tonight, God. Please, not tonight. I'm dying, but I know I'll be drunk tonight. You don't think I have a front row seat for the destruction of my life? I'm living it. But I can't warn you, because I don't understand what I suffer from. So I say things like this. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. It just got away from me. I don't mean to treat you this way. And that mumbling, though heartfelt apology, is woefully inadequate in light of the devastation I bring to my family. Jesus. But it's all I got. And I got alcoholism. And my family's got alcoholism. And we're being torn apart. And we're lost. And it's interesting that Bill Wilson said how dark it is before the dawn. I walk into a house that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism, and I find out that they had argued in my absence. My brother-in-law wanted to report the car stolen, and my sister negotiated him down to a missing persons report. And they saw me pull up, and they called the cops, and the cops are on their way up to do the follow-up work. I start yelling at my sister. I got warrants for my arrest in two counties. I'm going to jail. Thanks for nothing, because now it's her fault. I go outside to wait for the police because I don't want the interview to go on in front of the family. I don't know what I'm going to be saying, but let's all agree I'm going to be lying. I'm smoking a cigarette waiting for the cops, and here they come up the hill, the black and white unit, and I notice on the side of the black and white unit it says, K-9 unit. And I think, oh good, they brought the dog. Like I'm in any shape to make a run for it. And the cop got out and he started asking me those hard, tough questions because they are trained professionals. Like, where were you? And everything I remember is illegal, so I'm lying to him. And he's looking at my eyes really hard. And I don't like that because they're like bloodshot and rolling up in my head. So I break his gaze and he breaks with me and I break over here. And so now we're interviewing and dancing and... And I just wanted to divert his attention, right? And I saw the dog in the back seat, and I said, hey, is that your partner? And he said, well, yes, it is. And he walks over and opens his door, and this dog gets out. German Shepherd. Not a hair out of place. Like a Rin Tin Tin reincarnate. And with no prompting on my part, he started to relay facts to me about the dog's life. The dog is past mandatory retirement. They can't retire him. He's too good. The dog has participated in more arrests than any dog in the history of Ventura County. The dog has participated in more arrests and rescues than any dog in the history of Ventura or Los Angeles County. This dog was so phenomenal that the officers took a collection out of pocket to send him over to Europe for international competition where he kicked butt on German Shepherds, right? Yeah. And so I said to the cop, I go, well, that's a phenomenal dog you have there. And this thought flew in the back of my mind. The kind of thought, the minute you think it, you know it's the truth. You want to deny it, but you know it's the truth. And what the truth was, is this dog had done significantly more with his life than I had done with mine. I hated that dog. I didn't know that was going to be my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked back into that house that had been devastated by alcoholism. My sister wanted me to leave, and I begged for another chance. I gave an Academy Award worthy, tears down my face. You don't understand. I'm so sick. You can't just throw me away. I'll die out there. You got to give me a couple of days. Please, please give me another chance. I'll go to AA and everything. I have no idea why I said that. I think I was over-demonstrating, to be honest with you. And it's not that she believed I was going to go to AA. My first week in AA, my sister drove me to AA and picked me up from AA. You know how that makes you feel when you look the way I look and you get in your older sister's compact car at the end of an evening of Alcoholics Anonymous? She's driving you back to her house, her 31-year-old loser brother. So, Donald, what'd you learn in AA tonight? I don't remember my first night in AA, but I remember my second night because I won the lottery. But if you had told me you just had the greatest moment of your life, I would have said, what happened? I would have missed it. But here's what happened. My second night in AA, I attended the 6 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. It was an hour and a half long. It ended at 7:30. Between 7:30 and 8, there's a break. There's another meeting at 8 o'clock to 9:30, and I'm going to go to that meeting. And I got my back against the wall in the Simi Valley Alano Club, and I did not look that night the way I looked this morning. Trust me. I got hair down the middle of my back, and it's filthy because I don't shower anymore. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I can't speak the King's English anymore. I communicate with a series of hand gestures, grunts, and clicks. I'm wearing my sunglasses at night. I got my arms folded across my chest, and I'm looking at the room and looking at the people. I'm rocking back and forth, and I'm not doing this because I'm a tough guy. That's what I want you to think. I'm doing this because I'm coming up on 48 hours of a drink of alcohol, and I'm physically addicted, and I feel like I'm going to explode from the inside out. Every molecule in my body is screaming in unison, let's go get a drink. And the big book tells me my main problem resides mainly in my mind rather than my body. And as bad as my body was, this is what my mind started doing to me. Look at them, Don. Look at them. Look how clean they are. Look how happy they are. They all know each other. They're not coming up and talking to you. You know why? They don't want you here. Why do you do this to us, Don? Oh, you're quitting drinking? Oh, it's going to be different because you're in AA? You always drink again, Don. You play this game time and time again. How many times have we quit drinking, Don? 100? You take the pain, you take the pain, you take the pain, and then you drink anyway. Here's an idea for you, Scooter. Why don't you bypass the pain? Let's get out of here, and let's go get a drink. And I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous on my second night of sobriety to go get drunk, and it's going to cost me everything. It's going to cost me the love of the last relative that'll have anything to do with me, my place that I'm living, and more than likely it's going to cost me my life. But I got to tell you, it's a small price to pay if it will make the madness in my head stop for 5 minutes. And I've always been willing to pay that price. I've proven it to myself time and time again. And why would a man take such a desperate action in light of everything that was going to happen to him? I've lost the power of choice. Where the drink is concerned, I'm not involved in that decision. I have to go get drunk. And I caught a break. Because over in the corner were two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark. And it's the most important moment of my life. Whether I live or die is going to be decided in the next few minutes. But for Lou and Mark, it was Tuesday. You know what I mean? And these guys were where they were at every Tuesday between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. They were hanging out. Drinking that AA coffee, telling those AA war stories, but most importantly, they had their eyes trained on the room, and they had their eyes trained on the door, and they were looking for men to 12-step. And then they did what I think is the most important action we'll ever take in Alcoholics Anonymous. More important than writing an inventory, which is important. More important than making amends, which is important. But it's the action we take that allows all the other actions to become possible. It's our 12th suggestion. These two good men took a 30-foot journey across a clubhouse to cordially welcome a man to Alcoholics Anonymous who was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And they did it in the kind, unassuming way we're taught to do it. Hi, I'm Lou. This is Mark. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us? I'm telling you, that stuff saves lives. And the reason I believe it's the most important action we take, let me tell you what, 30 feet for Mark and Lou, for me, it's a million miles. Don't you know where I've been, who I've hurt, what I've done? Don't you understand? I can't get my eyes off of my shoes. You expect me to work the room? You expect me to introduce myself? You expect me to say hi? Well, I hope you pack the lunch because I don't have it in me. My scorecard reads zero. My tank is on empty. No, these guys understood the terms of engagement for recovery from alcoholism, that they would have to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And they sat me down on the table, and Mark sat with me, and Lou continued to stand, and Lou clapped me right in the middle of the back. He said, "Don, this is Mark. He'll be your sponsor." And then he walked away. And they assigned me my first sponsor in AA. And I know that's not done many places, but in my case, it's probably a good idea. And, you know, you hear things in AA, don't you? And you hear them, and then you say them to the next people. I say them to people because they were said to me. Like, you know, every meeting I go to, we talk about sponsorship. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. And what do we say to new people? Find somebody that has what you want. Huh. I wonder what I want coming up on 48 hours without a drink of alcohol. I don't know, maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac, you know. It's a beginning, because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, right? Because he's everything I'm not, right? Bald of head, wire-rimmed glasses, slight of frame, soft voice, and ooh, he loved God. You know, that thing that you hear people say, "I don't talk to the new man or woman about God till they get their feet underneath them." He didn't get that memo, right? Our first night, he's talking about what God did for him, what God did for her, what God did for them, what God was going to do for me, and he was expecting a miracle. He was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. He was armed with that spiritual enthusiasm. He told me we were the lucky ones. He goes, "You're one of the lucky ones, Don. You made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. Your troubles are over as long as you stay. They're out there on the streets tonight, and they're dying, but you're in here safe with us. Congratulations. I'm at the low point of my existence." He said it with such conviction, I felt better. Not much, but enough to listen to what he had to say next. And what he said next was I was going to be going to meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he got a meeting directory, and he started circling the meetings I'd be attending. Without my permission, I might add. And I remember thinking, that's a lot of circling. And he's talking about AA, and he's talking about God. And then he said, "Are you working?" I said, "Well, I'm currently unemployed." And he's more circling. And here's another weird thing about sponsorship and Alcoholics Anonymous, right? He asked me if I was working. I told him I was unemployed. And you know what he said? "That's great." That's a weird thing to say when you find out somebody's unemployed. I mean, out there in the real world, if you go, "Hey, man, what do you do for a living?" "Well, I'm currently unemployed." "Hey, I'm sorry, didn't mean to step on your toes. Hope I didn't make you feel bad. I'm sure you'll get a job soon," and you get away from them, right? Not in AA. When you're new and you say you're unemployed, we go, "Oh, that's great." Because we know, more meetings. You can focus on your recovery. Nothing to be between you and the gift. He was excited. Man, and my journey began. And I didn't understand, God, if you ask me, like, what are you excited about in AA, right? I'm excited about all the stuff that was given to me my second night of recovery. Isn't that something? It hasn't changed. It's my second night. Because what happened is I got a sponsor assigned to me, but he was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which means what? I'm going to be an active member, right? And because he's an active member, he has a home group, which means what? I'm going to have a home group. Because he has a home group, he has commitments, which means I'm going to have commitments. He knew everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 1,000 friends, which means I will have 1,000 friends. I didn't understand that when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you get a sponsor, you inherit their friends. Now, I want to be clear. When you're new, this does not feel like an asset. What it feels like is, man, there's a lot of people up in my business. But think about it this way, man. I'm at the low point of my existence, right? I burned every bridge, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I meet all this strange new crowd of people. And in very short order, you find out everything there is to know about me, good and bad, right? Yet you still love me and accept me and encourage me. Where are you going to get that kind of compassion anywhere on the planet if you're an alcoholic? Only a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I can tell. And my sponsor got me busy immediately. He believed that the desperation of the newcomer was the propellant that took us through the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he didn't want to waste any of it. And so he took me through all three sides of the triangle, unity, service, and recovery, simultaneously without ever telling me he was doing it. Isn't that something? He was a big believer that a drunk would rather see a beautiful sunset than listen to the best sermon in the world. And what he did is what we do in AA. He used the ancient spiritual principle of the invitation to bring another member into Alcoholics Anonymous and create another member for Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, we use invitation. He'd roll up on me and he'd say, "Don, I got to set up this meeting tomorrow night. I could really use your help." And I'd think to myself at the low point of my existence, wow, he needs my help. And I'd show up early, we'd set up some little meeting, and at the end of it, he'd shake my hand and he'd say, "Thank you." And it would produce the self-esteem of the right kind, where I felt like I was a part of something, that I was worthy. And I don't know why it meant so much to me. And I know today, you know, if you've been living in active alcoholism, you're living in loneliness. You're living in separateness. You feel like you're invisible. And you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're simply invited to join. And you get to partake in all the things that do it. And that action, being able for my sponsor to invite me to do different things in Alcoholics Anonymous, set up meetings, clean up meetings, go do institution work, go pick people up, drop people off, sitting there reading the big book, all these simple actions, inviting me to coffee, inviting me into his home, inviting me into his friendships, including me in everything, because the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, and inclusive, never exclusive. We believe it's available to all men. That's our marching orders at Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught that. I was raised that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. 30 years later, if I have an event, my wife and I have an event, we never have an invitation list. It's always an open event. When we got married, it was an open wedding. When we have things at the house, it's an open invitation. What if too many people show up? We'll figure it out. Because the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, inclusive. And if you follow God, you know who's going to show up? The people that are supposed to show up. We don't run the show. We're never exclusive because you taught me that. You didn't wait till I had my stuff together. You didn't say I was too deranged or too dangerous or too dirty or too smelly to be included. You invited me the first night when I wasn't worthy. You made me feel special. And you included me. And that spiritual principle of invitation saved my life. And I went through the steps and I had to make all the amends and I showed up in courtrooms and I paid back tons of money and I did. And all of these things conspired. And after all that, seemingly this work we do in Alcoholics Anonymous through the steps and all the things we do, what do you get for all of that? Do you get a pony? No, you don't get a damn pony. You know what you get? You have spiritual awakening. And when you're new, you say, "That's it? I paid back the IRS 80 grand and cleaned up 2 warrants and took crap and did this and cleaned up 1,000. I got a spiritual. That's it?" You find out it's the greatest gift every man or woman ever received. You see, if you're an alcoholic of my type, hear this. I was asleep. I was asleep. I moved through the world under a haze of alcohol and other substances, and I was asleep. And I worked the steps under your tutelage, and you woke me up to one thing, that there is a power that runs this thing, and it's of me, it's through me, and it loves me, and it's available to me right now. Now you've woken me up. And you told me my next action, which will continue for the rest of my life, is only one action. We do a lot of different things, but it's really one action. And you know what it is? Don't go to sleep. And so I have to come to places like this and be with people like you to do what? Not to go back to sleep. I go to my home group to do what? Not go back to sleep. I sponsor men and I listen and I take their problems on as if they were my own. And I get off the phone after giving them great direction that I don't know where it came from, but you know where it came from. And I go, "Man, where did that come from? That was brilliant. I should write that down." And you know what? And if it doesn't kill him, I might try it. You know, and you... I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay awake. Because what's funny is when I'm away from you, I start getting sleepy. When I'm away from you, I think I have problems. When I'm away from you, I think I have things to worry about. When I'm away from you, my alcoholism starts to be untreated. And I'm not a guy that believes that I got to live in meetings or I'm going to drink again. I'm a guy that believes I get to go to meetings. Why wouldn't I be here? Why wouldn't I be in Alcoholics Anonymous? What the hell have I missed in the last 30 years by being active in Alcoholics Anonymous? Nobody said, well, while you were in AA, boy, I was watching a lot of American Idol. You missed some great season. What the hell are you talking about? I've been all over the world. I've got great outside interests. I have a wonderful life. I got it. I've got everything that I'd stack my life against anybody. But it's not about what I do. It's about what we do. It's about how I feel when I'm with you. I want to tell you this, man. I used to go to meetings and I couldn't figure out how I'd go into a meeting quasi-insane. You know what I mean? You never look that way because we're always trying to look cool. Hey, Donnie, how you doing? Good, babe. How are you? You know? Can't tell them the truth. Hey, I think I'm going to kill someone today. And my wife, I'm pretty sure that's over, you know. Didn't like the way the dog was looking at me either. You know, you can't tell people that. So you just show up. You show up. People know you're sick because you're twitching. You know what I mean? But you show up. And I come to some meeting, man, and I go to meetings all the time, right? I get out of that meeting, you know, and I feel better. Well, I'm not a guy that can leave it alone. You know what I mean? I can't just be happy that I feel better. God forbid, right? No, I got to understand why I feel better. I was the same way when I was drinking, man. Drowning in a sea of booze, you throw me a life preserver and I throw it back at you and I go, wrong color. You know what I mean? And you yell at me, you're drowning. And I go, yeah, but I want to know why I'm drowning. You know? And it's like, I want to know why I feel better when I go to AA. I couldn't figure it out. One day I'm working with a new guy. We're in the book. We're in the second step. We're in We Agnostics. And I get that line we're all familiar with. Down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Maybe obscured by pomp, by circumstance, by worship of other things, but in the final analysis, it's only there he may be found. Guy's having trouble with the idea, the fundamental idea of God. What does that mean? What does that mean? I go, okay, forget idea. Let's throw that word out. How about light? The fundamental light of God is a man, woman, and child. He goes, oh, okay, I can get that. I go, yeah, there's a light inside you. There's a light inside me. You can't see it, but it's there. What you're looking for, you're looking with. He says, as much a part of you as the feelings you have for a friend. Got it, good. Had a great conversation. I started thinking about that afterwards. And I said, you know, maybe that's it. You see, I go out in the world, I got the fundamental light of God, idea of God with me. Everywhere I go, everything I do, God's right here. Then I come to AA, and guess who I bring? God, he's right here. I show up at AA. And this morning I came here, I brought my God, fundamental idea. You brought yours, you brought yours, you brought... Man, look at all the God in this room. And you know what I'm talking about. We talk about it all the time in AA. We say things like this, you can't see it, but you can feel it. Sometimes I sit down in my home group and nobody said anything to me. I haven't said anything to anybody. I just feel better. I can feel it. It's palatable. It's in the room. There's so much God in the room when I come here because I don't just bring my God. You bring yours. And sometimes there's so much God I can barely stand it. And sometimes it's so bright when we're together I can barely see for the light of God. That's why I feel better when I come to AA. 18 years ago, my wife and I left Los Angeles, moved to the Pacific Northwest, and we're city kids. We're concrete, steel, and glass, and suddenly we're 8 miles out of town. We're in the woods, right? And it's like we got wildlife, you know what I mean? 100-foot trees and deer in our front yard every day. I remember the first time I forgot a flashlight and I had to go out to the car for something. And it's dark in the woods, man. It's darkity dark, dark. And I got like halfway to the car and this little voice in my head said, cougar. And I just jumped up in the air and ran inside and slammed the door like a big sissy. And my wife's like, what's with you? And I said, dark out there, darkity dark, dark. And in the summer, man, the mama deer start bringing their spotted fawns over. I'm calling my friends in L.A. Oh, we got baby deer in the yard. Anybody needs 20,000 digital photos of a baby deer, see me after the meeting. And we're city kids, so we're freaking out over the deer. And this one baby deer, I fell in love with him, man, for a couple of reasons. One, he was super inquisitive. And the other is he had a big scar across his face. So I made up a story in my mind about how he defended his mom's honor and got stomped into the ground because I identify with that. And I named him, that's Scratch, and that's mama deer and Scratch. You know, and then rutting season comes in the fall and their coats start changing, getting ready for winter. But not Scratch. He started losing all his fur. I mean, big chunks of it started looking ugly, and I mentioned it to my wife, and she investigated and found out where we live, there's a thing called deer hair loss syndrome. And they get it as yearlings, and if they lose enough fur, winter will come, and they won't be able to eat enough to keep their furnace going. They'll get hypothermic, and they'll die. I said to my wife, I go, Scratch is going to die? And she goes, yeah. I go, oh, not on our watch. And we started breaking every Washington State wildlife management law in the books, man. We're doing supplemental feeding. I'm throwing 150-pound sacks of wet cob into my Toyota Avalon at the feed store. Guy's like, how many heads you got? How many head would this feed? You know, and I'm checking my principles at the door. I'm lying. My wife's setting up feeding stations. And when you got one sick deer, you can't feed the one sick deer. So we got deer coming from everywhere. My wife's in the backyard chasing out 100-pound bucks, 6-point bucks. Chase them out of the backyard. You're selfish. You're self-centered. Let the sick one eat. Where am I? I'm on the deck in safety. Be careful, honey. He's huge. You know? She's the courageous one. And it's not working, man. It's not working. Scratch is getting sicker and sicker, and I'm obsessed with this baby deer. And it got to the point where he lost all the fur in his body. He just had like a 2-inch wide, 2-inch high swatch of fur from his neck to his butt. And he says, now he's in the backyard. We've overfed him. He's just rounded out like a beer keg. He's this fat, ugly, mohawk, dying, newcomer deer, just eating and pooping in the backyard. And I'd go to work and I'd call my wife. Did you see Scratch today? She'd go, yeah. I go, how's he doing? And she'd go, not well. And I'd shake my fist at God and just crazy about this deer. And then, you know, we make it to spring and Scratch doesn't die. And for the next 3 or 4 years, he'd show up in our backyard in rutting season. And we knew it was him because of the scar. And now he's a magnificent buck, huge rack. And he'd walk right up to my wife and she'd feed him apples by hand. And I'd watch that and I'd think, what was it about that baby deer that made me lose my mind? And one day it hit me. I'm that baby deer. I'm that newcomer in the Simi Valley Alano Club with my back against the wall. With anybody with a glancing familiarity about alcoholism, you would have looked at me and said, that guy over there, he's going to die. And two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous saw the same thing and said, not on our watch. And I'm here to tell you, it's our watch now. While we're in here this weekend, safe, sane, and sober, having a very good time, they're out there on the streets tonight, and they are dying. And more importantly, they're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't even know it yet. But we have a conveyor belt of misery to our home groups, and the questions we have to ask ourselves as good AA members is this and nothing less. When these new friends arrive, where will we be? And more importantly, how will we be? Am I going to be in there talking about fantasy football, my latest fishing trip, the money I'm making, what's going on in the stock market, politics, all that crap that should never make it across the threshold of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or am I going to be like my teachers, Lou and Mark, hanging out, talking about AA, telling those war stories, looking for Newman, the 12-step? You know, the game we play here is you bet your life, and I need to remind us, because I need to be reminded, that they're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, they're coming looking for us. I hope we stay sober forever, and I hope we're ready. Thanks for listening.